Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are ready for the first case this morning, Sweeney against, I suppose now, Pence. And we'll hear from you, Mr. Pearson.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Dale Pearson. I represent the plaintiff appellants, Jim Sweeney, Dave Fagan, Local 150 of the Operating Engineers, and various of its members. The union represents about 4,000 employees in Indiana, primarily engaged in the construction industry, as well as a significant number who perform slag processing and mill service work. The union negotiates dozens of contracts with hundreds of employers on a continuous cycle. Contracts negotiated by Local 150 in Indiana customarily include union security clauses. Such clauses typically require bargaining unit employees to become members of the union and maintain their membership throughout the life of the contract as a condition of employment.
So just in the interest of narrowing the issues that are in front of us, I understand that you agree with the state that Section 3, Subpart 1 of the Indiana Right to Work Law is lawful under a long line of Supreme Court precedents.
Your Honor, 3-1 and 8-1, yes, because they do prohibit or allow.
They speak of requiring membership in a labor
right, organization. That's the phrase. That's
so we have no issue about that.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I think it's helpful sometimes to limit. My second question for you is whether I would be very interested in your comments on the decision of the Indiana court in Sweeney against Zeller that was filed as supplemental authority. It, of course, as you know, finds a takings problem under the Indiana Constitution, and it gives the state court's interpretation of Section 3 as being in keeping with what the various executive branch people said is prospective only. So if you could comment on that, that would be helpful.
I think that's right, Your Honor. And, of course, we submitted the decision by the Lake County Court primarily because that piece of the case was originally part of this lawsuit. But when the district court dismissed the union's suit, which involved mostly federal constitutional claims but these two state constitutional claims, the court dismissed it without prejudice to refiling in the state court. So what the judge ruled on late last week was that refiling of those state of Indiana constitutional claims, which were originally in this lawsuit. So I suppose the circuit court's decision, the judge does specifically say he agrees with the ruling of the federal district judge.
But then right in Part 3, it says the court enters a declaratory judgment that IC 22668 and 6610 are unconstitutional in violation of Article 1, Section 21 of the Indiana Constitution. So, of course, this court doesn't sit to decide hypothetical cases. Is there a controversy that we still need to entertain, or should we wait to see if this is appealed, or is this utterly beside the point? I mean, what is your position of...
Your Honor, we believe that the federal claims that the union brought in the district court are still live claims. The circuit court of Lake County, of course, can be appealed. The Attorney General of Indiana has said he's going to appeal it. He has the option, or I think he's got to go straight to the Indiana Supreme Court. That provision of the Indiana Constitution is unique. There is no parallel theory that we've advanced under the federal Constitution. So, regardless of the outcome there, I think that the federal claims that the union has raised are all ripe and legitimate, appropriate for review by this court.
Okay, so here are the ones that bother me most of all on that. You have argued, among other things, that Section 3 of the Right to Work Law violates the contracts and ex post facto clauses of the U.S. Constitution. And a premise of your argument is that there is some retroactivity to the statute. You've talked about maintenance of membership clauses. And if it were just the executive branch saying we don't mean to do anything prospective, you might have an argument, but it's a well-established procedure in federal court for the federal court to say, let's get an authoritative interpretation of a potentially ambiguous statute from the state court system. The United States Supreme Court, for instance, did that in Bilotti against Baird. And we now have, I recognize it's the circuit court, it's not the Indiana Supreme Court, but we have an authoritative interpretation from the state courts about the prospectivity of Section 3. And I'm sure the Attorney General is not planning on challenging that. You might, does this, again, in my theme of is there any way we can narrow this case, does the state court assurance that Section 3 is prospective dispose of your contracts and ex post facto arguments?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because, well, for two reasons. First, I believe that both the Lake County Court and the U.S. District Court erred in finding that the Section 3, the so-called construction industry carve-out, is not substantive because it does seem to permit these maintenance of membership clauses. It is fundamentally different than the Section 8 prohibitions.
But, so, you know, let me just interrupt you and say you certainly argued that. I understood your argument. And when you're dealing only with an executive branch, the political dynamics are different. A later administration might change its mind. But when a court gives a potentially ambiguous state statute an interpretation that would avoid problems under the U.S. Constitution, or for that matter under the state constitution, we allow these limiting constructions. This happens from time to time when there are these sorts of laws. And I'm trying to figure out whether the Indiana court, the Lake County Court's decision is precisely that kind of limiting construction that allows us to say with some confidence now, it's not just the executive branch saying, trust us, we'll do the right thing. It's actually a valid interpretation of state law.
Your Honor, it's my understanding that we to have the option to appeal that ruling by the Lake County Circuit Court. The judge did find in our favor on the one count and ruled against us on four other counts. So it's not a final determination yet. I think the fact that we can skip to the Indiana Supreme Court, if we can bring our claims as well as the Attorney General's stated intent to bring that claim, then it seems to me that we could get that final determinative ruling from the Indiana Supreme Court. But until
then, it is a funny position for you to be taking. You're forced to argue this is a really awful statute, and because it's so awful, it's really very harmful to us. That way, we create the there arises the federal constitution.
Well, and Judge, I'm willing to concede now that we've considered this and studied it and read both district judges' decisions. If the courts agreed with us that the Section 3 carve-out does create an exception for these maintenance of membership clauses, then the fact that it might be retroactive really isn't a problem because it's not impairing existing agreements. So in that sense, it wouldn't be a violation. So I'll give everybody that one. I think that that's important. But the district court judge did specifically say, and now the Lake County judge did specifically say, that they thought that Section 3 was not substantive. And I think that's got to be wrong because it seems to permit these maintenance of membership clauses.
Okay. So that takes us to, I think, the heart of your case, which is your preemption challenge to, or if you want, what's the scope of 14B, arguments about Section 3.2 and Section 3.3. So here there's just a difference in interpretation, I think, as to how far the Supreme Court's decision in Retail Clerks 1 and 2 went. Is that a fair statement?
I think that is a fair statement, Your Honor. And if I could just point out, Section 3 does mirror Section 8 of the state court right to work law. We say they're both substantive, but it's that Section 8 prohibitions. 8.1 is
okay,
the one
that
says you can't use the membership or
Condition
membership employment.
Pay dues, fees, assessments,
right,
or other charges.
So right.
Right. That's what I meant, actually. You can't, and you agree that 8.1 is a lawful statute.
Squarely within this narrow grant of authority that Congress gave the states.
So it's the fair share dues prohibition that you read in 8.2 and the charity substitute provision that you read in 8.3 that's the focus of your attack.
Yes, Your Honor. The 14B language is explicit, that the exception to the national labor policy permits states to prohibit, quote, the execution or application of agreements requiring membership in a labor organization as a condition of employment. The use of the word membership can't be accidental or inadvertent. I think that the plain meaning of that term and this phrase requires the courts to recognize that Congress was looking to offer a narrow exception to the national labor policy for which it has granted an exclusive federal agency authority to interpret. It's true.
And you don't read Beck or any of the other cases as calling the fair share people members.
Correct.
They are non-members, in particular, who are just paying for services rendered.
Yes, Your Honor, and they are, and by definition, they are non-members. And it's an important distinction. We talk about some of the cases under the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act that doesn't give fair share fee payers or other non-members the benefits, the protections of members, which were afforded in the Union's Bill of Rights in that statute. Now, I realize it's a separate statute, et cetera, but there is no definition of member or membership in Taft-Hartley or in the National Labor Relations Act. So I think it's fair to look at other statutes like that one in determining what Congress meant by member. And I think that there's nothing in the Act or in the legislative history that suggests that it meant to be broader than the literal reading of member. Moreover, Your Honor, if Congress wanted to outlaw clauses that required people to pay any dues, fees, et cetera, you know, mirroring the language of Section 8.2 or 8.3 of the Right to Work Law, it could have said that. I mean, there were state laws out there at the time that used those phrases. So we think that Congress knew what it was doing in limiting this to membership. And the reason we know that, it comes from this extensive legislative history that you've seen discussed in GM, in retail clerks, in Beck especially. Congress wanted to get rid of the closed shop. That was the objective. But it had a twin purpose. It realized that if you got rid of the closed shop, that is requiring people to be members before they could get hired, then you created the possibility or the problem of what Congress called the free riders. We call them the free riders because we say the union, because of its duty of fair representation, is required to represent these folks. But the right to work law says they don't have to pay anything for that representation. So
what's
now you've created
the difference between we'll call it a non-right to work state, which are most of them, when they divide the fair share. They're saying, well, the people in that union do have the right, under Beck and others, to say they don't have to pay for the political stuff. Now, but they still had to pay their fair share for whatever you want to call it, the normal work within the union.
Correct, Your Honor.
Are you trying to impose the same thing on right-to-work states?
Yes, Your Honor. The representational fees, that's the phrase, that are costs incurred by the union that are germane to collective bargaining. That's another one of the buzzwords, germane. The Supreme Court struggled for decades to try to find this balance, to protect individuals who didn't want to support political causes that the union was trying to advance. And so now you've got this long line of cases in the public sector and the private sector that say those individuals need not join the union and they need not support the political causes with which they disagree.
But they still have to pay dues for the rest of it.
That's what Senator Taft said back during the Taft-Hartley debates, that they have to pay the dues.
If you go that way, then right to work doesn't mean anything.
Your Honor, I think that the parallel of goals at the time the statute was passed, I think Congress understood that that might be the outcome. It was a concession to states who had already adopted these laws. The states can still require or prohibit contracts that require membership, but the law has converged now. I mean, it's been a long time since the statute was passed. And
but
I think
what's
that
the difference between, say, a monthly union dues payment and just a fair share payment?
Your Honor, the Beck law and the California saw and knife case that gives the labor board back
authority.
No, but I
mean, like, generally speaking, you know, do people like $30 a month versus 15, or, you know, what's the difference?
It's about 10% to 14% over the last several years for Local 150 members and non-members. We are required under that line of cases to conduct an audit annually, and that number then tends to fluctuate.
So it's 10% to 14% lower for the fair share?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it's because you're taking the not only just political expenses, but what they call institutional charges. They're the ones that individual objectors, non-members, don't have to pay.
So in a state that is not a right-to-work state, you can require membership.
Yes. Well, you can require the payment of the fair share.
No. I'm going further. In a state, Illinois is not a right-to-work state. So in Illinois, is it possible for you to require union membership?
Not anymore. That was the meaning of the GM decision that was decided the same time as the retail clerks cases. They said that you can't actually require membership, that membership or its practical equivalent, you can't force people to join the union.
Okay.
You can, in a state like Illinois, you could require people to pay their fair share, but under federal labor law, the way the labor board has interpreted BEC, that class
just across the board,
that's
in the country.
Right, that class of fair share fee payers is now a protected group, but we can require, the unions can require people to pay that. But that's
so if you have a union shop or whatever it is, the workers elect to have a union, there are those who, even if it's elected, they don't have to join the union.
Correct.
But at the same time, they're going to have to pay their fair share.
Correct.
And all I'm trying to figure out is, when you talk about a right-to-work state, it sounds to me like you want to impose the same result in Indiana.
That's correct, Your Honor. Because
okay, well, that's important to me, at least. That's what you want to do, and that's where I think we have...
The question is, what does federal law then say? Is that what federal law requires? So would it be possible under federal law for you as the union to negotiate a two-tiered wage structure? Say, for people who are union members, you're going to pay X dollars an hour in the bargaining unit, and for people who are non-members, you're going to pay X minus $10 dollars an hour because we won't process grievances for them and we won't... we're just not speaking for them?
No, Your Honor.
That's Del Castillo, right?
Right. The duty of fair representation that the Supreme Court created in 1944 basically says you have to represent everyone equally. That's
the union doesn't actually have the option of not representing the non-members.
That's right. Nor can the union petition for a unit of just members, what they call members only. That's illegal under the board law as well. Your Honor, in sum, as I see my lights going off here, I wanted to touch on, first, we say that BEC has resolved this problem, the fair share free rider problem, for everyone. And this narrow grant of authority that the states had doesn't go beyond addressing membership specifically. But now that the problem's been resolved, the state right to work law can only go so far as to prohibit membership. I just wanted to touch then briefly on our equal protection problem. When you've got this class of people who don't have to pay anything, it draws resources away from the union that it would ordinarily spend properly on political causes. The union has fundamental First Amendment rights.
It's being forced to subsidize those other people.
Exactly. And that 10 to 14%, Your Honor, by taking 10 to 14% away, it doesn't take many people to object, to basically wipe out the political program. Because that 10% to 14%, to the extent that it's the money that's going to the political stuff, it's going to get siphoned off to represent a small fraction. Literally, if you had objectors of about 10%, that's a complete offset. So it's not like it's just limiting our First Amendment activity. It's wiping out the political program. That's the essence of our equal protection argument. And I do want to reserve a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
Sure.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to come in here today.
You are welcome. Mr. Steiner?
May it please the Court? We do have a fundamental disagreement about what retail clerks means and the fact that I think retail clerks and the legislation clearly means that there is a big difference, intended to be a huge difference, between right-to-work states and non-right-to-work states.
Well, you know, my problem with that, I have retail clerks in front of me here and, of course, looked at it. And the court's language, I read it as saying that you can't play games with the labels of what you're doing. If what you have, what they say right here at the top of page 1465 in the Supreme Court Reporter version, is the practical equivalent of an agreement requiring membership in a labor organization as a condition of employment. And unlike the situation that Mr. Pearson describes, where there's a meaningful difference in the amount of money, it was the precise amount of money. So I see Retail Clerks 1 and 2 as saying, you can't play games with the labels. If what you're really doing is functionally membership, practical equivalent of membership, you can call it a banana if you want to. It is something that you cannot require if it's a 14B state. Now, you're arguing for an extension of Retail Clerks, which you're more than welcome to do, and we can certainly listen to that. But I don't see Retail Clerks, and he says, actually, Justice White says a little bit later in the opinion, it must be remembered that the service fee is admittedly the exact equal of membership initiation fees and monthly dues, and that, as the union says in its brief, dues collected from members may be used for a variety of purposes in addition to meeting the union's costs of collective bargaining. So that's what Retail Clerks is doing. And, of course, the Indiana law does more than that.
It does. But I think
and
that Retail...
And Section 14B says nothing in this subchapter shall be construed as authorizing the execution of agreements requiring membership in a labor organization. So you have to be taking the position that Congress doesn't really mean the word membership in a labor organization. It means something more.
We are taking that position because I think...
But why should we read the language to mean something more if they use the word
membership?
Well,
I think that for the same rationale that the Supreme Court in Retail Clerks 1 and 2 referred to more than just the term membership.
Well, but
they
what
really
I'm saying is membership or its practical equivalent, you know, membership by whatever name, but I don't see why membership in a labor organization means non-membership in a labor organization.
Well, when you have a situation where these kinds of issues are embodied in these security agreements, and the amounts that are assessed pursuant to those security agreements are very significant.
So explain to me why the union, under obligation under Del Costello, is required to give free services to the non-members of the union?
Well, in that particular case, I believe that was not a right-to-work case.
Explain to me why the union has to give free services. It costs money to process a grievance, for example.
Well,
you have to have people read things.
Well, we do have, you know, sort of the dichotomy. We have a significant number of right-to-work states, but
you're not answering my question. Why does the union have to provide free services to non-members?
Well, I think in that particular case, it's an assumption that the union has considerable authority over what's going to occur in that particular labor agreement, and that if the some rights of the non-members are not protected, that there's a potential for them to be completely excluded from the employment.
So why does the union have no right, in your view, to collect an exact amount of money? We can audit, we can do all sorts of things, but the exact amount of money that those services entail?
Because to some degree that is the functional equivalent of membership.
But why is it? If federal law requires the union to represent everyone in the bargaining unit, they can't carve it off. If they could carve it off, I would think you'd have a fantastic argument. But if they can't carve it off, and they're required to give services. This is, I think, what bothered the Lake County Court as well. You are not ordinarily in our society required to go, you know, a plumber isn't required to just go fix somebody's water system without being paid. When people render services, they are entitled to be paid. And if federal law imposes the obligation, I don't see how you can get around that.
Well, it is a much different kind of situation. First, we have this situation where the union essentially wants to impose most of the costs on the non-members. The only reason why they wouldn't impose all of the costs is because of these cases like Beck that have come along in subsequent years that say, listen, you are going to be given some right if you don't agree with a particular position being taken by the union not to support that.
But that's a different argument. And if what you were saying is that the fair share is set at too high a level, go for it. I mean, that that's what you just said, that the fair share is too high. Maybe it should be only 50% of the regular instead of 80% or 85%.
Well, we're actually taking the position that any payment can be prohibited in a right-to-work
state. Right, and so you want the union to be forced by federal law to render services but precluded by Indiana law from getting any payment for the services it's rendering. It is not allowed to represent a subset of the workers at a place who happen to be union members.
Well,
You agree with that?
Under federal law, it is
not allowed to represent only the union member subset.
I think this is all right.
Yes, okay.
I'm not arguing with that. What I'm really arguing with is the fact that in these particular environments where the union really has control over the negotiation as, you know, what is going to be the terms and conditions of employment to a large degree, I think what we're recognizing is that there needs to be some protection, sort of an equal protection protection.
It's not equal protection,
of course, because it's not the state. But, I mean, there's a sense that these people, if we don't require some fairness in the representation, they're not going to be represented at all. And the bottom line is going to be that only union members are going to be working for that employer in the end.
Suppose the Supreme Court had gone the other way in Del Castello and had said, we really want to protect the rights of people to be in or out of a union so the union can restrict its bargaining for union members only. And the non-members can do it any way they want to. They can do it one at a time. They can, in any other way they can think of, they can arrange their own terms and conditions and wages and whatever else they might want to have. And they won't strike, and they'll do their own thing. Then it seems to me you could say there's nothing the union is doing that those people are benefiting from. But that's not what happened. And you may wish that Congress or the NLRB would change federal labor law, but right now, don't we have to operate against the backdrop of federal labor law?
Well, the union is already negotiating for its own members without any question.
But it's being forced to give services to everybody. That's why I mentioned grievances, which is one of the big things that unions furnish in workplaces. There's normally a no-strike clause. There's a grievance process in its place. But if a non-union member is disciplined some way, then the union has to process that person's grievance.
Granted.
Okay. But it has to do it for free in your world. It doesn't have to pay.
Well, I think given the context, it's really all about, are we really forcing union membership in these settings? If we do what you have said, Judge, and we force the individuals to not have any protection through, a contract that is negotiated, but instead have some sort of individualized contract, the bottom line likely will be that we'll only have union membership there in the long run. Because
that would all be, an employer would have to almost insist on that.
They may have to insist
on
that.
Well, if you're going to talk about having to individually each person come forward and argue for their own thing, they say, we're not going to put up with that.
I agree.
And so they're going to have to. Now, my question to you is this has been around a long time. Are there any right-to-work states that have this kind of a formula where they do impose whatever you want to call it, free, having to pay for what it before was free? Any other right-to-work states?
I'm not aware of that, Judge. I can say that.
I mean, is this going to be the first right-to-work state that's going to have this kind of a formula?
No. Or do you know? This Indiana law is...
I don't mean the law. I mean this adjustment to the law where you... free riders, they call them. Is this going to... Are there any other states? I think there are 23 right-to-work states or something like that, 24. But whatever it is, are there any other of those 24 states that have a formula that requires what they call free riders to pay their fair share.
I'm not aware of that, Judge. I'm not aware that they.
Well, not aware.
I think
that
what I was going to say
is the first one. That's, I guess.
Is no,
one.
This the law. The
first
law
one who's going to require free riders to pay their fair.
Well,
share.
We don't. We. Oh, I mean, if that was required in this situation.
No, I'm not sure. I'm understanding your answers to Judge Mannion's question.
And maybe I'm not understanding your question.
In the other right-to-work states, number one, does their statutory language include the equivalent of parts 2 and 3 of Indiana Code 22668?
No, we haven't cited it specifically, but I understand they are.
So that's new in Indiana.
Well, no, it is not new. In fact, counsel pointed out that there was language like that in laws even before Taft-Hartley was
two
passed.
And three? No. So anyway, so you think so the second question, which may I think is what Judge Mannion was asking, is in the other 23 or so right-to-work states, at this moment, do the non-members of the unions pay back fair share compensation to the union?
I cannot say for all 23 states, but in general, I do not believe so.
You don't think so? I'm not sure about that. But anyway, we can find that out.
And certainly, counsel has not cited to any situation like that. And in the cases that we look at that have been cited are essentially cases in states that are not right to work.
There should be a huge amount of law in this for the Fifth Circuit, where Texas has been right to work forever.
That's right. And, you know, in retail clerks, 1 and 2 were way back in 1963.
But they talk about the practical equivalent of an agreement requiring membership, where the fee is exactly the same.
That's
it's
right.
It's not the same as what you're doing.
And we submit that you do not have to have the precise fee. Essentially, the union is arguing that you that retail clerks only applies in a situation where you have the precise amount of money being charged to non-members.
Well, that was the factual situation in retail clerks.
But that just happened to be that particular situation.
Well, you think that's unimportant? They think
I don't, because I think the Supreme Court was talking about the importance of giving effect to the law.
No, they were talking about the practical equivalent of an agreement requiring membership, and you are extrapolating, which may be a fine extrapolation.
Well, I think that if you pay 90% of union membership dues, that's pretty close to being required to be a member.
I see that as a different issue. Anybody who thinks that the fair share membership, we see cases like this all the time in the Seventh Circuit. Somebody thinks the fair share membership allotment is too high. They refuse to pay. It gets adjudicated, and it has to be adjusted if it's too high. That's a perfectly lawful thing to do.
You know, if you look at...
Could you talk for a minute about the significance of the state courts, the Lake County courts decision?
Well, at this point, I really don't think it has any significance. If the Indiana Supreme Court ultimately decides this case, and it will...
Now, I'm curious about that process, too. Can the state take a direct appeal to the Supreme Court?
Yes, it's actually required to take a direct appeal to the Indiana Supreme Court
because
the state court declared the statute to be unconstitutional. In that situation, the Indiana Supreme Court has automatic jurisdiction.
But there's one theory that's still pending before the trial court, correct?
I really didn't look at that decision closely enough to know that. If it is, then it may not be yet time to take the case, but ultimately there will be an appeal taken of that decision.
So you have to wait for finality, a total disposition.
Yes, or you could ask that it be made final. You know, I really don't know. I haven't studied the opinion closely.
I don't know why you say that, because paragraph 4 of the Indiana court's decision, this is the final page, page 7, the motion to dismiss is granted with respect to 2, 3, 4, and 5. Motion to dismiss is denied as to count 1. So that's the part that Judge Tinder may be talking about. Declaratory judgment of unconstitutionality. And then 4, the grant of any relief is stayed pending the perfection of an appeal by any party, and if appeal is so perfected during the pendency. So.
Well, that's sort of an odd formulation. Is what I would say. I think the court is intending to make his decision appealable, And I think we probably will take that position and take the case to the Indiana Supreme Court at this time. Now, the union will have the opportunity to cross appeal as part of that process. And, you know, and that's why I say I don't think the decision has that much significance at this time. I agree that it is intriguing that counsel filed that decision when only on that one Indiana State constitutional provision did the court rule in favor of the union.
Well, counsel acted responsibly. This is a decision that's very pertinent to the issues before us.
I'm just saying I don't really think that it really has finality at this point.
You think they should not have told us about it?
That's fine to tell you about it. I'm just saying that the consequences of that decision are that there's still going to be an appeal. So we know it's not final. So, I mean, if there was a final decision from the Indiana Supreme Court.
In the interest of comedy, should this court hold back until the Indiana Supreme Court has had an opportunity to rule?
You would be in a position to do that if you so chose. You could do that if you believe that there is are issues.
Wouldn't we get help in reading how we read at least Section 3, if nothing else, by waiting for the Supreme Court?
You may. It really depends on whether the parties litigate that. I hear today that matter would probably be litigated. It's certainly not something that we would raise on appeal. So to a certain degree, I'm speculating at this point. That's why I'm just trying to be honest about whether this decision really has any import at this time, because we don't know what is going to be presented to the Indiana Supreme Court as a certainty and what, of course, they will decide in the end. So you certainly have the authority to wait and see whether something comes out of that decision that would be useful in making the decision in this case.
But what if the Indiana Supreme Court, obviously if the Indiana Supreme Court disagrees with the Lake County Court and says the statute's entirely okay, then the issues that the plaintiffs here have presented for us are just as live and needing resolution as they are this minute. If the Indiana Supreme Court, on the other hand, says the statute is unconstitutional under just compensation grounds because it requires people to give free services, then the statute is struck down. And so the posture of the case before us becomes very different. It looks like now we'd be asked to give an advisory opinion on whether there are a couple of more reasons to strike it down, and normally we don't do that. So I can see one avenue in which, as you're arguing, absolutely nothing happens of very great interest to us, and another avenue in which things of profound importance to us might happen.
I agree entirely. I think that it's really a matter of discretion on your part, how you handle this particular issue at this time. You could decide to defer until there is a decision by the Indiana Supreme Court.
Or at least you're more or less standing here saying you are going to appeal it, and I think you will too. But, I mean, we would wait to see if an appeal were perfected in the proper time.
That's correct. But given the vagaries of the situation, because we really don't know what's going to happen, this court is also in a position to decide we don't want to wait a year or a year and a half until the Indiana Supreme Court makes a final decision in this case.
No, I agree with you. We have that discretion. We want to exercise it wisely.
And that's right. So I think you can. What I was really saying is I don't think there's anything in that decision that is really dispositive at this point in time. When the Indiana Supreme Court decides something finally, there probably will be some dispositive matters decided. So it does become a question of discretion on your part how you want to handle this particular appeal. And if you want to wait, you certainly have that authority. If you want to decide, you have that authority too.
Okay, that's fine.
But, you know, the bottom line we see here, two things. I see my light's getting
time
ready
waning,
to come on.
Yes.
But we do think retail clerks should be read much more broadly than the union says. And certainly the fact that there can be a much manipulation in terms of how contracts are created means that we have to be very wary about what they're arguing. I see that my time is up. I would ask that you affirm the district court. I think the decision was a good one. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Steiner. Anything further, Mr. Pearson?
Yes, Your Honor, I would like to make a couple of points briefly. I think it's important, Judge, the one comment that you made about the costs. You know, if there's an employee that Local 150 represents who is discharged, we take those things very seriously. We don't draw lines between members and non-members. We take discharges, almost every one of them, to arbitration. Arbitrator's fees these days are $1,500 a day. We write briefs because it's a lawyer presenting the case. Transcripts cost about $1,000 for a full day's hearing. I'm a salaried lawyer. You know, my time has, I mean, everybody's time has value. So there are real costs incurred, and we provide these services to everybody. It's not just, you know, something that you can spread across and sort of forget about. Your Honor, the question about are there any states that have a formula or that tried to get into the fair share formulas? We cite a case in the brief at page 13. It was this NLRB versus North Dakota case, where under the North Dakota right-to-work law, apparently the state tried to impose a fair share type of requirement, a service fee requirement, so that if you took that non-member's case to arbitration, he would have to pay for it. And the decision in that case was that that is preempted by the Labor Board's exclusive primary jurisdiction. The law has evolved to the point where this expert agency now has complete authority to address these questions, and it was this court in 1998 that enforced California Saw and Knife. And this court said you can think of almost no issues that are better suited for resolution by the Labor Board. It's the Labor Board's jurisdiction, Your Honor, and I'm going to thank the court again for the opportunity to present
this. Thank you to both sides. We will take this case under advisement.